I've talked to many people both across the U.S. and internationally, folks who have been part of the movement, and there's a tremendous sense of goodwill towards South Africa. People want South Africa to do right, to get well.
The American role in South African change on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Last time on Common Ground, we looked at the enormous political and social changes shaping a new South Africa. This week, we'll look at how Americans participated in the movement to end apartheid, and we'll talk about the role Americans can play in bringing about a peaceful and successful transition. Among our guests are Imani Countess, Executive Director of the Washington Office on Africa, and Charles Moses, Executive Director of the New York Governor's Office of Black Affairs. First, we hear from Annette Hutchins. She's International Consultant for the Soft Sheen International Foundation. I asked her what role U.S. public opinion played in bringing change to South Africa.
I think that it certainly was one of the very important moral consciences, if you would, that helped say to the world that apartheid must end, and I think that that was a very significant role.
Yeah, I think it was driven by the parallelism between the movement there and civil rights movement, the experience of African Americans and people of conscience in this country, and what we saw observed over there. I think. And I think that a lot of the key players in shaping public opinion came from the United States and expanding the movement abroad, Europe, and other places.
And Ms. Countess?
I would say that U.S. public opinion played a pivotal role in shaping U.S. policy towards South Africa. And I would draw out just two very specific examples. The first is the growth and development of the divestment movement in the United States, where individual citizens at the local level, appalled at the situation in South Africa and angry at the government, the U.S. government, lack of response, took it upon themselves to try to do what they could within their local areas to try to influence policy. And the second example that I would draw on is the actual overriding of a presidential veto, the first time in history that a U.S. President saw his veto overridden on a foreign policy issue. That came not because Congress was necessarily fully opposed, because I would say that all of Congress was not united around sanctions, but they felt compelled to override that veto because of the tremendous public pressure.
We hear a lot about, like you say, international and national sanctions. I'd like to know from you how important you think the local and state sanctions were in the case of South Africa. Ms. Hutchins, do you have an opinion on how those local sanctions affected the issue?
Well, I think they assisted in giving the legislation some enforceability, that if you were purchasing from your state or supplying your state and your state mandated that you could not do business in South Africa, I felt that that was a very important edge in terms of enforceability, because and it would hurt the pocket, because if that contract was cut off from you, from the state or the city, then it gave it enforceability. Because I think in other parts of the world, when you look at sanctions, often one of the difficulties with sanctions is the enforceability. And I felt that the city and state laws provided us with a means where it counted to assist the process.
And Mr. Moses, you work in a state office.
I think that the sanctions extended the reach beyond exponentially. New York City, $30 billion economy, budget. If you did business with South Africa, you couldn't do business with the state. $36 to $40 billion in pension funds, divested New York State, a $50 billion economy, $55 billion in pension funds, a lot of money out there that if you did business with New York, with South Africa, you couldn't do business with those, with the state. Excuse me, not so much the state, but with the pension funds. It was, so I think that it was a significant extension of the reach and breadth of the problem, and it forced people who would otherwise not focus on the problem to really focus on the problem, that is the pension fund managers and some of the corporations. And so I think that the sanctions had a positive impact in that sense of the word.
Ms. Countess?
There's not really much that I could add to that. I would agree with everything that has been said. In some cases, state and local sanctions were, in fact, more important than the federal sanctions. If IBM has to look at losing a statewide contract in California or Texas, if it has to look at losing a multi-million dollar domestic market versus an insecure investment in South Africa, you know, it's very clear what their choice is going to be.
Okay. I'll stick with you to ask this next question, Ms. Countess. I think the American public feels good, especially the ones who are involved in the movement, feels good about what's happening. Is there a role that the public can play in the transition?
I would first want to agree with your first statement. I think that people do generally feel very good about what has happened. And I remember speaking with someone a couple of weeks ago who watched Nelson Mandela address the United Nations. And this was someone who had been involved in the anti-apartheid struggle for decades. And there is a feeling that one cannot describe when you know that you've been part of a huge social movement whose aim has been to try to address incredible injustice in South Africa. And even though South Africa is still fraught with problems, when you're at a point where you're looking at someone who's been in prison for 27 years and suffered, you know, incredible abuses and so on, addressing the United Nations, and not just addressing the UN, but saying now is the time to lift sanctions. That's an incredible moment, and I think all of us who've been privileged to be part of this movement feel a degree of satisfaction. Is there more that needs to be done? Without question. And I think many people are figuring out how, or trying to figure out, how is it that they continue to plug in and continue to be supportive of this transition process that's underway in South Africa. I've talked to many people both across the U.S. and internationally, folks who have been part of the movement, and there's a tremendous sense of goodwill towards South Africa. People want South Africa to do right, to get well. And maybe it's because we can look at our own situations and find so many problems. We just, you know, we want them to somebody has to be able to do better. And so maybe there's some of that in there as well.
I think for an African American, I think that some of the source of the goodwill is that South Africa seemed like the last bastion of really overt and blatant institutionalized racism. And, of course, we know that there are other places in Africa where there are problems. And it seemed like, I remember when I was in college, we used to talk about, you know, if Africa is free, we will always be free. And it seemed like South Africa was an important part of that puzzle that had to be put in place. And it looks like it's going to be put in place.
Can I say, yes, I've just spent the past 6 months in South Africa, and I am a practical, can-do person. And, you know, I was there setting up an education and training center. And I think that there are many things that we need to begin doing. We have a major, for instance, child care movement here in the U.S. There are many women whose sons and husbands were killed in prison, killed in the movement, killed in the liberation struggle, who are working to support their families, who need child care. I think when we say the American public, I think that we need to begin to isolate the institutions in which our American public is represented. education, which has been set up for a small number of people, all of a sudden has to educate 30 million people. We have a diversity of educational institutions, from Saturday programs to evening programs to 3-month programs to 1-month programs, that I think that we have some things to share. It may not look just like our programs once we enter into the dialogue, but I think we have some things to share that need to be shared, because you have a generation, several generations of young people who decided to stay out of school as their contribution to the struggle. But now, who is going to employ them? And do we not have a responsibility to them to ensure that they do not end up living on the streets? And the issue of violence, we're struggling with that in our own urban centers. And there are some people who are meeting with gangs and others. I mean, are there not some things that the youth movement, whether it's the YMCA or the YWCA, the church, too, had its own apartheid, so that we have a role to play in terms of the institutional church to talk about the development of African congregations that are representative of their spiritual and cultural lives. The major issue of housing and urban development and employment are major issues that I think we have some programs that South Africans are already talking about, but that we also have some success stories that we can share in terms of creating entrepreneurs, because there is a entrepreneurial culture in Soweto, in Alexandria. And how do you shape that so that those people with some business experience can now move into more formalized experience with appropriate training and capital? So I wish to encourage the can-do mentality and not a lot of time at being confused. Yes, enjoy the celebration, but I hope that we can participate in a mutually beneficial way in the development of a country that I think can be truly great.
I think that add a little bit here. I think that while it's very true that there's a lot that individuals can do in the United States, there's also a very important role for the U.S. government. The U.S. is already supplying South Africa, mainly South African non-governmental organizations, some $80 million, which is, when you look at the overall Africa budget, a not insignificant sum. But I do think that there is much more that the U.S. could do in terms of its diplomatic efforts. One of the areas of concern to our organization is the violence in South Africa and the potential impact that violence will have well into the future. It has already cost some 11,000 lives in the past 3 years and seems to be on the rise. And I'm specifically talking about political violence. We think that the U.S. government could give a bit more attention to not just talking about how bad violence is and how people should not do it, but actually begin to identify those individuals in South Africa who are talking about violence and talking about bringing the country to war. If their particular point of view, their narrow views, are not incorporated into the political discussion.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with three experts on the role Americans played in bringing an end to apartheid in South Africa. This is the second in our two-part look at the amazing changes shaping a new South Africa. Our guests are Annette Hutchins of the Soft Sheen International Foundation, Charles Moses of the New York State Governor's Office of Black Affairs, and Imani Countess of the Washington Office on Africa. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Mr. Moses, a lot of issues have been raised in those two responses.
I want to ask you about your role in sanctions and your opinion on what Bishop Tutu called the reverse sanctions now. But will we be able to participate in this development? Will American business return?
I want to put myself down on the can-do, in the can-do group. I was not so much an anti-apartheid activist as a person who was a former journalist and was aware of the problems in South Africa and came into government. And in the years I've been involved in government, have gotten involved in trying to find ways of shaping government to address South Africa and other areas where people of color are located. And so one of the things that I think that could remedy the problem that you just described, Imani, is the imposition of systems that will allow the African majority to cease to be marginalized in the economy. I think the more people you can get involved as employees and employers, I think the more you lessen the possibility for violence. And so in my state, New York State, I chair a committee, a working group, and of high-level state officials, and what we have done is developed a partnership program in South Africa. And we have just basically gone through the whole state and looked at all of our major agencies and all of our major initiatives and looked to find ways to shape programs to be of assistance to the people in South Africa. So we've got the program ready to go. We're going to wait until after the elections are held to execute it. The ANC has looked at it, as have other elements and other agencies and groups within the South African populace. And so we're confident that once we get, and we continue, I should say, to get input from different organizations and different individuals, and we're confident that once we get started with the program, that we will also bring along the private sector in New York State, financial services organizations and other corporations, which are looking for things to do. My concern is with violence, but also with trying to find the quickest possible way to incorporate and increase in the role of Africans in that society.
Ms. Hutchins, I have another business-related question related to American business. As it begins to return to South Africa and resume operations, will it be the same U.S. businesses that were there before, or are there new opportunities, new things that will be happening?
I think there's a combination of both. I think that during the sanctions era, some businesses, as they withdrew, sold their licensing or basically did partnerships with other companies, for instance, in the case of IBM, who's now trying to move back in, to South Africa. I think that you'll have new businesses, Lotus, Microsoft. I think that the worldwide economic recession is forcing people to look for new markets. Because we are downsizing, in the United States, and yet there needs to be continued growth. And so part of that growth will be to identify markets that have an infrastructure that certain businesses can operate within. I think that it'll be a combination of both. I think that capital is going to be an issue in South Africa because it is difficult in the boardroom to get people to go to an area where they still see that there is some risk. And I think that
There's likely to be some strictures
placed on
they can conduct themselves.
Right, and I think that people are waiting and watching, but some are not waiting and watching. I've given you the names of a few who are moving ahead and feel that no matter what, that there is a market. And I'll never forget in another country, I was talking to somebody from Colgate Palmolive, and they said, "Well, hey, in any country you can sell toothpaste." And so I think that you're going to have a combination of both. I think that housing is needed. So I think ultimately you're going to have construction firms going down because one of the major problems are going to be around housing. I think that education is going to be a multi-billion dollar business in South Africa simply because all of the population that needs to be educated. So all of those technologies and businesses related to education. Healthcare is going to be a major issue. So I think you're going to have a multi-billion dollar business in healthcare so that businesses related to healthcare, have both expertise and technologies that they can share.
Ms. Countess, did you have a comment?
The only comment that I wanted to make is that It is certainly true that there needs to be an influx of business, of foreign capital in to South Africa. But there's also the reality that apartheid created an economy that is incredibly distorted. And oftentimes it's difficult to get a full sense of that unless you're there. Even reading about the distortions of apartheid don't really give you the full picture until you actually get there. And what you see is an economy that has been, throughout its history, systematically distorted to benefit a very small part of the white minority. And if there is not a very careful addressing of that distortion and that historic inequity, an influx of capital and an increase in business will not address the fundamental injustice that was able to mobilize thousands of people in this country and around the world. And so that is I think, a very important fact that we cannot lose sight of. And related to that, I would just want to say that there are individuals in South Africa. The church is very active, and in fact, the church, probably with trade unions, are taking the lead on these questions of economic restructure and how one relates to new business that's coming in, how you monitor and assess the behavior of business coming in, and so on. And I think that their efforts are certainly things that we should be supporting in this country in a variety of ways.
Now, that sounds like an issue that an issue that this new South African government will have to deal with. Is that what you're talking about? I mean, a way for them to perhaps limit some foreign investment, redirect some foreign investment?
Well, everything that I've heard coming from those organizations that will be represented in the government is that they will develop a set of investment laws, they will work with business, but they have an incredible task of trying to get as much investment as they can get because they need the resources to deal with the incredible poverty.
To be able to govern.
Exactly, to be able to govern.
Yeah.
Just like in this country, however, it has not always been, and will be in South Africa, it will not always be the government that's able to sort of secure the rights of workers. If you look at this country, if you look at the United States, it's been a labor movement, it's been other social forces in the country that have come together to force a minimum wage, to force a standard work week, to force
but also
the
imposition
of child labor
laws.
But
we've come to a time in the labor movement when management and labor have now had to work together in order to keep plants open, in order to keep people employed. And I'm raising that because I think that you're going to have to see some of that cooperation.
Absolutely.
And are seeing some of that cooperation in South
Africa. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And I just wanted to sort of draw, though, the distinction. I don't think the government will have the capacity to do everything for its people, but some of the impetus for change is going to continue to come from those organizations outside of government. It may well be, in many instances, that they will be in collaboration with business, but sometimes it's not going to be.
Well, let me end on that and go around and get a comment on what Imani Countess has said and ask you if what we can do then, if you're talking about building these social structures in South Africa, and there are all these people in the United States who are concerned, who helped the change process come about, who now want things to succeed. Is there something we can do to help that that social structure develop? And we'll start with the Sutchins.
Well, I would want each American to be focused, and that means if you are a street cleaner, if you're a housemaid, there's a tremendous domestic workers movement in South Africa that I think the more informed way that you grow and you help the situation grow is to do it in a focused manner based on your profession, your work, you know, your extra curricular activities. And I really stress that because I think that you can create problems doing it on a broad perspective without an informed background. And so if you're in child care, that I think that each individual American can be in touch with an institution or an organization that is working in their same area here in the United States and to dialogue about what they can do no matter how small, you know, that is.
All right, Charles Moses.
I agree. I think we used the example of the Middle East and Israel. We have Israel Bonds. You have organizations which are formed to support certain sectors of the Israel economy or any economy. I think that, you know, we ought to have that extra governmental, private sector organizations, voluntary organizations, community organizations that are dedicated to helping, providing assistance to South Africa's future. And not only just assistance in council, but also some dollars. And I think that we can do that. I think there will be calls for that. I think that over the years that the agenda will change, new problems will emerge. You mentioned healthcare, education, agriculture, big problem. They might need some help and some expertise, but they may need some money, you know, in terms of reorganizing their agricultural structure. I can just the problems and the issues are infinite, but I think that now that we've had the movement, of course the activists will be activists, but I think now that the mix is going to have to include a lot of other types of people with different concerns and interests, but who can still play a key role in the process.
And Imani Countess, I'll give you the final word.
Well, thank you. I think that there are going to be a number of people listening to this broadcast who will not take up the challenge that's been put before them and try to develop people-to-people exchanges. And it's to those people that I would want to speak. Because even if you feel like there's not enough time or enough space in your life to deal with this issue in the way that's been described, there still is, I think, opportunity for you to influence what happens in South Africa, and that is through this government. If one could just simply take the time to, first of all, follow the issues and be informed, and then also take the time to write a letter, to place a phone call to your representative, your senator, the State Department, and so on, encouraging the U.S. government to take an active role in exercising its diplomacy relative to South Africa, that would also be of significant assistance.
That is Imani Countess. She's Executive Director of the Washington Office on Africa. Our other guests have been Charles Moses, Executive Director of the New York State Governor's Office of Black Affairs, and Annette Hutchins, an international consultant for the Soft Sheen International Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. To order a cassette of this two-part Common Ground series on a new South Africa, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for program number 9350. That's program number 9350. Visa and MasterCard are accepted. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, to order cassettes, please use our toll-free number, 1-800-767-1929. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.